our next session, we'll go from China to India, a very, very different rival, if you will. And we'll talk a little bit about Pakistan. These are two nuclear powers that most people don't talk much about. And we'll do that in the next session. Well, we're in the Kings of the East, Part 2, the second session of our briefing package on Asia. In this session, we're going to talk about the rise of India and how it got fragmented to Pakistan and Bangladesh. And then we'll summarize the growing dominance of Asia in global terms. We're going to highlight something else that is on our horizon that's impacting all of this, and that's the impending monetary crisis while all this is going on. And we'll close with a bright spot. So we're going to go from China to India and Pakistan. Now, India, of course, is the other major player in what we consider as Asia. It also starts about 2500 BC, as best we can determine, the Indus Valley Civilization and the Vedic Aryan Age. The origin of the Vedas were at the core of Hinduism. They were ruled by the Aryans, a nomadic people from Central Asia there again. Their society divided into hereditary groups. This was the beginning of the caste system that cripples India today. The Brahmins were the priests, and the Kshatriyas were the warriors and rulers, the Vaisyas the merchants, farmers, and traders, and the Sudras the artisans, laborers, and servants. And the disastrous thing about this is you were born into one of these groups, and it was very, very virtually impossible to extricate yourself from that identity and that commitment and that destiny. Then we get to the Magadha Empire and Alexander's conquests, finally reach India, as you may know. And then the Mauryan Empire. I won't go through all the details here because there are all these subsequent kingdoms, various dynasties, until you get to the Gupta dynasty. This was the golden age of Indian civilization, the flowering of their art, literature, and science, and so forth. So this is in the 4th and 5th centuries, 4th through the 6th centuries A.D., so we're now about the time of the Council of Nicaea and all of that in the Christian world. India's level of science and technology in those days was probably higher than that in Europe. We tend to think in European terms India was ahead of them. The use of zero and positional notation, the foundation of mathematics, the decimal system of numerals, later transmitted to Europe by Arabs, was a major contribution to modern mathematics that had its roots in India. Even to this day, if you read technical papers in the field of the frontiers of statistics, advanced statistics, you'll find most of them are written by Indians. They seem to have a facility for that particular kind of thinking. We get to the 6th to the 10th centuries. We have regional kingdoms, and that's where Hinduism is beginning to replace Buddhism as far as India is concerned. Then we have the Muslim invaders and the Mongol Empire. Genghis Khan and all of that in the 13th century. And we go through a number of these others till we finally get to the 15th century, the European conquests, the Portuguese, very aggressive under Vasco da Gama, the Dutch, the French, and, of course, the British. And the British obviously becoming the dominant factor in those influences. In the 18th and 19th centuries, the British Empire ruled in India from 1756 all the way to 1947. So Britain has their thumbprint on everything here. They exploitively administered the 565 principalities under their rule. You need to understand the Industrial Revolution in its social terms, especially 18th, 19th centuries. The economies of India and England became increasingly linked, but not in a fair way, in a sense. The opening of the Suez Canal in 1969 reduced the sailing time between Britain and India from 3 months to 3 weeks. So that improved the connectivity. Now, despite that, in 1914, industry accounted for less than 5% of national income in India. Less than 1% of India's workforce was employed in factories. So this was a one-way street, if you will. Strictly, India was a source of raw materials and a market for their goods. There wasn't any development of any real infrastructure in India by the British. So that led to rebellions and problems, the rise of Indian nationalism, the Indian National Congress in 1885, the Muslim League in 1906, Mahatma Gandhi, of course, He was born in 1896, but from 1915 through 1948 was his time of influence. So in addition to India's burden, carrying Britain on its back, so to speak, they're also fighting this battle divided among themselves between the Muslims and the Hindus, primarily. Bitter rivalry between them. They finally do get their independence through Mahatma Gandhi's unusual efforts in 1947. And they had the Nehru government from 50 to 64 dealt with industrialization, the National League, a policy of non-alignment. But they have increasingly hostilities with the region known as Pakistan. And then there's nationalization of banks under Indira Gandhi and the liberation of East Pakistan. Two portions of India get split off in the hopes of moving the Muslims into their own territories. So the idea was to have the Muslims go to Pakistan, east and west Pakistan, and let the Hindus come out of there and live in India. They thought that would be a path to peace. But years of turmoil and so forth. We won't go through all of the other challenges here, except the Hindu-Muslim rivalries overlay everything. Key point, though, in May of 1998, after five warhead tests, it's clear that an ICBM test in April 1999, that India is a nuclear power. You need to understand that. Now, let's talk a little bit about Pakistan. That's obviously just to the west of India. And Bangladesh, what was East Pakistan, renamed itself as Bangladesh. They both have a similar tale, if you will. The British had ruled India for 200 years. Indian National Congress in 1885. The Muslim League was formed in 1906. Irreconcilable differences. I think we have some insight of what it's like dealing with Muslims as we watch the antics in the Middle East. So Pakistan is separated on August 14th of 47, virtually right on the heels of India being made an independent state. West Pakistan is as it is today. East Pakistan was later renamed Bangladesh. So these two Pakistans are separated by 1,000 miles of Indian territory. So Pakistan is separated, and then India is made independent. And the idea was there'd be demographic migration. And 3.5 million Hindus and Sikhs move from Pakistan to India, and 5 million Muslims move from India to Pakistan to create a Pakistan state, a Muslim state in Pakistan, and to allow India to be primarily a Hindu state. 562 princes in each region to put together choose one or the other. Sounds like that ought to work, right? Wrong. There are three princes that decided to choose neither. And weak men kill people, in effect. So the three princes that choose neither, Hyderabad, who was a Hindu ruler but had a Muslim population, Jinnagad, who was a Muslim ruler that had a Hindu population, and Kashmir, who was a Hindu ruler but 85 Muslim population. Well, the first one settled by Indian arms in September of 48, less than a year later. The other one, India annexed his territory because it had a Hindu population. So far, so good. Kashmir's the problem. They decided to join India. Pakistan questioned their right to do so. War broke out. India occupies 2/3 of that state, and the deadlock still persists to this day. So there's tensions there. Now, what makes this exciting is that Pakistan is also a nuclear power. People overlook this. In fact, they're probably the most troublesome one on the planet Earth. I'll show you why in a minute. Kashmir remains unresolved. War preparations are imminent. There's a character by the name of Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan. That is a name you may want to remember. He's the father of the Islamic bomb. He's a German-trained Pakistani metallurgist that was employed in the Netherlands. He worked at Urenco, which is a top-secret atomic energy plant in the Netherlands, and while there, in 1970, he stole their nuclear enrichment plans and technology. And then he spent the next 28 years with Chinese scientists and others developing his Islamic bomb, which is heavily dependent on understanding effective ways to enrich nuclear material. On May 28th of 1998, Pakistan joined the nuclear club. If that was all of the story, that's bad enough, but it gets a little more complicated because Khan aggressively is marketing his plans and technology to all comers. He's the one that's been providing the technology to Iran. He's the one that offered it to Libya. He's the one that's been going around the country trying to promote this because he is a Muslim, and that's all consistent with his interests. So Pakistan, the tensions continue. India and Pakistan are both arming, did nuclear weapons tests in both 98 and 99. And there's all kinds of elections, declarations signed, but principals convicted of hijacking terrorism, sentenced to life in prison. The tensions continue. We don't need to follow all those details here. Let's summarize the rise of Asia in another sense. China has tripled its per capita income in one generation. Tripled it in one generation. That's never been done before, to my knowledge. They lifted 300 million people out of poverty. That's larger than the population of the United States. They are now the major world competitor for energy and commodity resources. They bought virtually half of all the cement on the planet Earth last year. Many projects here in our community have been delayed because of the inability to get cement. There's a worldwide shortage in contrast to demand. It's all the same thing true of cotton, rice, coal, crude steel, aluminum, copper, wheat. Oil is on the list. It's probably the most critical. Their share of the world consumption is only 8%, but still, it's going to be the one that's the scariest. Now, crude oil has gone to in the neighborhood of approaching $60 a barrel. People are taking comfort that it's dropped a little bit. They're blaming it on the oil companies. There was a day when it was $6 a barrel. Gas was $1 at the pump. Now the barrel costs 10 times as much, and it's only cost twice as much you follow me? So it's not as simple as many people would like to make it sound. The efficiency of distribution is fairly substantial. But Goldman Sachs has announced, shocked everybody, saying it's going to go to $100 a barrel. Very easy to understand. Now let's talk about India. They have research and development centers everywhere. We think of India as push carts and elephants or something. No, it's the software platforms, the multimedia features for the next generation devices. Most of them, the most advanced ones, are being designed in the Bangalore Technology Hub. Motorola, Hewlett-Packard, Cisco Systems, etc., are having their most advanced teams ensconced in India. 3D computer simulations to tweak designs for car engines, forklifts, aircraft wings, for General Motors, Boeing, etc., are done there because that's where the most advanced simulations, etc., are available. The next generation service companies, you know, the outsourcing of back office work. It sounds strange that you could outsource back office grunt work to India. They do it, and they have done it so well, they're legend. Their back office work is expected to quadruple by 2010 to over $56 billion per year just to process paperwork because they do it so well. The Bangalore Research Hub spawns companies producing their own chip design, software, and pharmaceuticals. Give you some examples. $50 air flights are on the deck. Crystal clear 2 cents per minute cell phone service. $2,200 cars are all going to be coming. We're all talking 2007, 2008 kind of deliveries here. Cardiac operations by top surgeons at low rates, etc., etc., etc. Sheenman, the CEO of Cisco Systems, is quoted as saying, "We came to India for the costs. We stayed because of the quality. And we're now investing because of the innovation." They're really doing a job. They're really doing a job. They're transforming the entire global economy. They're analogous to 19th century America. In what way? They have a young, driven workforce. They grab lead in agriculture, apparel, and the high tech of the era. Steam engines, the telegraph, and electric lights. This describes America in its heyday, and it's echoing the same parallel as occurring in India. China and India account for one-third of the world population, and in just two decades, China has been growing at 9.5% per year, India is growing at 6% a year, And both are projected to continue at 7-8% for decades. Not just a few years, for decades. There's basic ingredients that are causing this to happen. Barring some cataclysms, within 3 decades, India should pass Germany as the world's number 3 economy. By mid-century, China should overtake the U.S. as number 1. Together, China and India could account for over half of the entire output on the planet Earth, between the two of them. They have, strangely enough, they have complementary strengths. There's enough differences that I'm not saying they're going to pull together as one might expect them to, but if they did, it's interesting that the technical and managerial strengths in both China and India are becoming more important than simply cheap assembly labor. I remember being shocked at one of my board meetings, one of prominent, so I can speak freely, I won't mention names, but one of my board members very prominently pointed out to us that in those days, our nemesis was Japan. We were in the semiconductor business, and Japan was the big gorilla on the block growing. Pointed out to us that we had this image that Japan was succeeding because of low-cost labor. He says, that's silly. You're blinded. Go visit the plants. You go through the plants, there's no employees. Go through an Nikon plant or Canon plant. It's all automated. A few guys walk around and make sure the machines are working. Lights are off because they don't need the lights on, except when they're inspecting something. What's the secret? The secret in those days of Japan was not cheap labor, it was cheap capital. They had because of the cheap capital costs, they could invest handsomely in advanced equipment. And some of the same things are going on in the Far East. It's not just because they have cheap labor. They do have cheap labor, but to think that that's the answer blinds you what else is going on. In China, they have mass manufacturing, multi-billion dollar electronics and heavy industrial plants. They have the equipment. They have attracted the capital to do that. India has the opposite problem. They don't have the capital, so they have to deal in services, software, design, and precision industry. So they're very different between each patterns. Technology. Graduate engineers and scientists. China and India graduate 500,000 engineers and scientists per year, against the United States, 60,000. They graduate virtually 9 times more than we do. Think about the implications. In the life sciences, China and India graduate 1,600,000, will by 2008, an increase of 35%. The U.S. will graduate 760,000 in the same period, a drop of 11%. Where they have an increase of 35 from an already larger number. Interesting. Merchandise exports. There's a plot of trillions in it's formatted in trillions of dollars. Both are growing. China, of course, is eclipsing India because they have the capital to put the muscle behind what they're doing. IT and service, it's the other way around. India has gotten the information technology and the service kind of sectors. And they're eating China's lunch in that regard. The return on capital is interesting. India's return on capital is higher, meaning it's better managed. China's about 12%. India's over 17.5%. Non-performing loans is an interesting story in itself. The non-performing loans in India has been declining. They're managing their businesses. China's non-performing loans are up in the way up in the double digits, which is this from the International Monetary Fund. So India's doing a better job managing. Foreign direct investment, India's is growing, China's is just exploding. The per capita GP, the earnings per person. Here again, we've got an interesting story in that both are growing impressively. One of the things to realize is that as China breaks the 1,000 per year income, that creates a population with disposable income. That's going to have that's having a huge impact on China. The average age of the workforce is interesting. Is that they're obviously the average age of all of them is increasing, but here's a place that India has an advantage over China. Because of the China's going to become victim to its one-child policies over the long run. Population of billions, of course, they're way out there. And India going beyond China for that reason I just mentioned. China's passenger market this year should reach 3 million. It's the number three market in the world. Largest base of cellular phone subscribers in the world, 350 million. Expected to reach 600 million by 2009. India has rocketed from 5.6 million to 55 million, a factor of virtually 10 to 1 since the year 2000. And China's expected to overtake the U.S. in homes connected to broadband within 2 years. China is expected to overtake the U.S. in broadband home installations within 2 years. This is the residential internet subscribers. Here are the cellular phone users in both India and China, just expanding. It's amazing how this is allowing them to accelerate their culture because they don't have to wait for hardwire. It makes a big difference. Finance and accounting, engineering, millions. China's way out there. India's ahead of the U.S. Life sciences, likewise, with the U.S. declining. GDP projections. U.S. in these projections is projected to increase dramatically. Let's hope so. But India's growth and China's growth being vastly faster. And there, all the assumptions are posted on the chart. Let's talk about the world gross domestic product in 2004. U.S. and the EU, roughly the same. EU slightly larger, that shocks many people. India, 2%, China, 4%. By 2025, the EU and the U.S. will be still about the same according to these projections, and India and China beginning to mushroom. And by the time we get to 2050, we have India and China. Well, first of all, China larger than the U.S. and India larger than the EU in its percent of contribution. Japan shrinking down to 4%. Now, these are very rosy projections by various think tanks, but let's take a look at the negatives. There's been 1 million premature deaths in China and India attributed to air pollution. That's going to get worse. 30 million are projected to be infected by HIV and AIDS by 2010. This is from the National Intelligence Council of India, the previous one from the World Bank. So there are some clouds they've got to deal with. The other thing, according to the CIA World Factbook, 203 million workers will be without full-time employment. There's 9% unemployment in India and about 20% unemployment in China. Some other caveats about the U.S. The projections that are put forth by these think tanks ignore, in my mind, some factors such as the fact that we kill one out of every four births, which otherwise would enter the workforce, since Roe versus Wade. And maintaining global market share under increased competition and technology education are other factors. It's not clear to me that we have either the technology or the desire or the will, the commitment, to maintain market share, let alone increase it. So there's another issue that overlays all of this that I'd like to touch on. The impending monetary crisis. The U.S. dollar versus the euro, the European euro. We have to understand where we are with regards to what's called the debt bubble. Let's understand that President Bush and the current Congress have together authorized and borrowed more money from foreign governments, banks, and companies and citizens than all of the previous 42 administrations combined. From 1776 to the year 2000, the first 224 years of U.S. history, 42 U.S. presidents borrowed a combined $1.01 trillion from foreign governments and financial institutions. This is according to the Department of the Treasury. In the past 4 years alone, the Bush administration has borrowed $1.05 trillion. Now, admittedly, these are not corrected for inflation, so they're misleading from that point of view, but it's still a shocker. The federal debt increases $300 billion per year. $300 billion per year. The trade deficit, that's a different issue, that's our economy as a whole, that where we buy more than we sell, by a tune of $800 billion annualized. America is now debt addicted and has to borrow, between 2 and 3 billion per day. See, if you add the 300 billion that the government spends more than it gets, and the 800 billion the entire economy spends more than it gets, that's a trillion one. Trillion one. And if you run that, that means you're talking 2.7 billion per day. Per day that we have to borrow. The question you'd like to ask is from whom? Whom? Why would they lend us? The total outstanding debt now exceeds the staggering $8 trillion, which a large majority, of course, is owned to foreigners. Two-thirds of the world trade is conducted in dollars. Over 70% of central banks' currency reserves throughout the world are held in American currency. The sole currency used by the international institutions such as the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is, of course, dollars. So understand the prevalence of the dollar, which is the reason we've been able to borrow. See, this confers on the U.S. a major economic advantage, the ability to run a trade deficit year after year and still be able to borrow, because we're dealing in the most common currency. It can do this because foreign countries need dollars. Why do they need dollars? They have to repay their debts to the IMF, which is substantial. They have to conduct international trade, of course, and they need to build up their currency reserves. For those three reasons, foreign countries need dollars. The U.S. provides the world with these dollars by buying goods and services produced by foreign countries. But it does not have a corresponding need for foreign currency, so it can sell far fewer goods and services in return. Thus, the U.S. always spends more than it earns, whereas the rest of the world always earns more than it spends. The U.S. trade deficit has now reached extraordinary levels, with the U.S. importing 50% more goods and services than it exports. You would think it doesn't take a lot of insight to realize that is not a long-term steady-state model. There's got to be a correction along the way somewhere. And by the way, this 50% more goods and services is currently results in a deficit of over $800 billion per year. That's an annualized rate. Meanwhile, let's take a look at the euro. Getting its share of this free lunch has been one of the motivations behind establishing the euro in the first place. Were the euro to become a reserve currency equal to, or perhaps even greater than, the dollar, countries could reduce their dollar holdings while building up their euro savings. See, the euro is an asset-based currency. The U.S. dollar is a debt-based currency. The EU countries would be able to reduce their subsidy to American consumption, and other countries would then be subsidizing the EU consumption and debt instead. Get the picture. The EU would love to trade places with us, so to speak. How do they do that? By unhooking the dollar from being the reserve currency around the world. A move away from the dollar towards the euro would have the disastrous effect on the U.S. economy, as the U.S. would no longer be able to spend beyond its means. That would do it. That would bring accountability into our focus here. It gets worse. The U.S. would have to become a net currency importer, as foreigners would probably seek to spend back in the U.S. a large portion of their estimated $3 trillion, which they currently own. So if they unhook that, there's going to be a flood of dollars looking for homes. So there would be more dollars around here, which means that's called inflation, probably uncontrolled inflation. The U.S. would have to run a trade surplus for the first time in 100 years, providing the rest of the world with more goods and services than it was receiving in return. Can we regain a posture of being a producer rather than a consumer? That's the only way this thing would a disaster could be prevented. A rapid and wholesale move to the euro might even lead to a dollar crash, as everyone sought to get rid of some or all of their dollars at some time. Now, that's probably not an outcome that Europe, Russia, or China are seeking, because of the huge effect it would have on the world economy. They're not looking for, they would prefer what they would call a soft landing, for this kind of inflation to occur gradually, that these dollars would flow gradually. None of them would have an interest in bringing the U.S. down or the whole world economy down, except one group probably, and that's the Muslims. They would cherish that kind of an opportunity. Now let's talk about the oil exporters. When the U.S. dominated the world oil production, sales of oil and natural gas on the international markets have been exclusively denominated in dollars. That made sense because we were a 50% exporter. So they were all those contracts were designated dollars. up until the 1950s, when the U.S. accounted for half or more of the world's annual oil production. The tendency to price in dollars was also reinforced by the Bretton Woods Agreement, which established the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and so forth. And they adopt the dollar as the currency for international loans. The vast majority of the world's countries are oil importers, not exporters, and since oil is such a crucial commodity, and increasingly so, the need to pay for it in dollars encourages these countries to keep the majority of their foreign currency reserves in dollars, not only to be able to buy the oil directly, but also to protect the value of their own currencies from falling against the dollar. They do so defensively. A sudden devaluation of the country's currency against the dollar would lead to a jump in oil prices and a possible economic crisis. So every country's central bank needs dollar reserves so as to be able to buy its own currency on the foreign exchange markets when it needs to be supported. So there are insurance policies that have dollars in their central banks. 70%, get this picture, 70% of the world's currency reserves are in dollars. Most banks carry some dollars, some euros, and some others. 70% collectively are in dollars. Probably 20-some-odd percent in euros and the rest in francs, yen, what have you. The fact that oil sales, loans, and from the IMF so far the dollar denominated also encourages the poorer countries to denominate their exports in dollars, as this minimizes the risk of losses through any fluctuations in the value of the dollar. And of course, since so many of these exports are essential raw materials for the richer countries that they need to import, the denomination dollars reinforces the need for countries to keep their own currency reserves in dollars. So because of all of this, there's incentives for both the smaller countries and also the larger countries to have major dollar reserves. So there's a quiet game going on that you don't read about in the media. The denomination of oil sales is not a subject which is frequently discussed on the 10 o'clock news. But its importance is certainly well understood by governments and the major economists. For example, in 1971, President Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard. When he did so, OPEC considered moving away from dollar oil pricing, as dollars no longer had the guaranteed value they once did. The U.S. response was various secret deals with Saudi Arabia in the 1970s to ensure that the world's most important oil exporters stuck with the dollar, and because they did, OPEC did also. But that was because there were deals drawn. Well, in March of 2006, an interesting event is scheduled to take place. The Iranian oil bourse is scheduled to commence operations on March 20th of 2006. The word bourse, by the way, is the European term for what you and I would call a mercantile exchange. It's a trading floor. In this case, it's primarily for petroleum products. This bourse will be a trading exchange whereby the nations of the world will have the option of selling and purchasing in euros rather than dollars. All comers, all importers, all exporters are welcome to deal, do trade through their facility. This bourse will directly compete with the two existing exchanges which happen to be American owned, the International Petroleum Exchange, the IPE in London, euros, and this represents a direct threat to the supremacy of the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. It's not just the oil contracts at issue. Suddenly now, all the banks of the world will no longer have to Foundation for the Economics of Sustainability points out, countries switching to the euro reserves from dollar reserves will bring down the value of the U.S. currency. Imports should start to cost Americans a lot more. The impact of a reserve currency switch would be catastrophic for the U.S., according to the global politician. The U.S. would simply have to stop importing. If Iran launches its IOB, the Iranian oil bourse, Iran's ambitious, saying that, quote, the impact of the could be worse than Iran launching a direct nuclear attack. Their words, not mine. Some pundits have even suggested that this could be a logical explanation why the Islamic Republic appears to be the U.S.'s next target. China's doing something interesting. They're going to use oil as their reserve currency. The Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco has just recently, last month, pointed out the dollar's position is already on the decline in many countries. China has officially declared that it will diversify part of its forex holdings, foreign exchange holdings, into oil by building a strategic petroleum reserve. In other words, why not use black gold as the reserve? Construction of storage tanks has begun this year and will take several years until completion. Smart move. A couple other things going on that should be sensitive to this whole area. Alan Greenspan is no longer the head of the Federal Reserve. There's a new leader by the name of Helicopter Ben Bernanke. In order to prevent deflation from occurring. But because of that, he picked up a nickname called Helicopter Ben. But he certainly is more concerned about deflation than inflation, which means he's going to be an expansionist. Now, the Fed, that's called the M3. If you take economics 101, you know that there's M1, M2, and M3 as the major measures of liquidity in the country, M3 being the most important one. Now, the economies have traditionally used this to monitor the liquidity of the United States. It is no longer going to be published by the Fed. That is interesting. Very quiet little move they've made, but shock to anyone that's paying attention to global economics. So one of the things from this briefing I'd like you to consider is that your personal stewardship plans for yourself personally, for your family, and for your community need to maintain surveillance on the likelihood of serious inflation ahead and perhaps worse. As part of your homework, keep an eye on what's going on, not just to the economy, but also to the monetary situation. They're similar, but they're not directly linked. You want to understand each one. They're different. The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. The Bible warns us. So that, indeed, that is true. Well, I said that we would talk about the bright spot. Oh, before I do that, let's stand back and notice something else I think is interesting. Civilizations of the world started in Mesopotamia, Babylon, the Persian Empire. Then they migrated to Greece, then to Rome, the centroid of power in the planet Earth, that is. And, of course, the 16th through the 19th centuries was pretty much Northern Europe was calling the shots worldwide. But then from the 19th century on, we get the centroid of power shifts westward again. And Henry Luce quipped in 1941 that the 20th century was the American century, and very realistically it was. The 20th century was the American century. But it's interesting that people are now expressing rather openly that the 21st century is going to be known as the Asian century. The Asian century. That's where most of the production. But it's not over then. It's not over then. Because we know from the scripture that it's going to migrate back to where it started when God himself will set up his kingdom. But I do find it fascinating to stand back from all of this and see the centroid of power migrate from that region to Europe, to the U.S., to Asia. It seems to be migrating westward back to the climax that we're all studying in our Bibles. But I want to give you a little bright spot, because I just got back from India recently. I had a chance to be at the Gospel for Asia Seminary in Tiruvalla, India. And we flew to New Delhi and then down to the southern tip, virtually, Cochin, in the southern tip of India. And we had a chance to visit this fabulous place. The guy in the middle of those three guys is K.P. Yohanan, who spent 25 years establishing Gospel for Asia. And you need to understand what he has accomplished. The facilities there, of course, are gorgeous and full of intensely committed young people who, when they graduate from that seminary and go out to the mission field, they know they go under penalty of death because both the Hindus and the Muslims are out to kill them. It's interesting to be in that whole culture and see their commitment to things. This is KP's son, Daniel, who's a great kid. And some of the facilities are quite modest, very traditional. Others are quite modern and delightful. We had a wonderful time there with these incredible, encouraging young people. But they also, they print 240 million different pieces of literature per year. And the presses there, I expected to see Mealy Gauss Dexter or some of the large from the U.S. or Heidelberg from Europe. No, no, they were tack presses built, designed and built in India, modern things. And we could go on and on about this, but it's quite an operation. We spent a week at their 168th seminary. They have, I think, 54 Bible colleges throughout Asia, but this is a seminary that supports them. They have 8,000 students preparing for full-time ministry. They have already trained 14,000 pastors, missionaries, and evangelists. They have planted 21,000 functioning churches. They are conducting 20,000 Bible studies that will become churches. They plant, get this, 16 new churches per day. They plant 16 new churches per day. They run daily radio broadcasts in 92 different languages. There's 300 in India. 240 million pieces of literature, Bibles and so forth, produced in 18 languages per year. There are 38,000 children in their Bridge of Hope system. These are Dalits. These are the low castes. K.P. Yohanan expects to have 100 million conversions to Christ out of that, out of the Dalits, because they are addressable. 100 million. We can't imagine those kind of numbers. But the 38,000 children are both Dalits and also tsunami victims. And so if you're interested in this, if the Lord calls you to take a look at it, their website is easy, is gfa.org, Gospel for Asia. And if you should write them, use our name, mention us. We'd be glad to do that. So we have been looking, of all the strategic trends, we monitor a dozen of these. The rise of Asia, we're calling the kings of the East. We have briefings on all of these things on our website as well as published packages. I want to give you a challenge. I like to close with this challenge because I really believe it. But it's so preposterous, I hope you don't accept it. I hope you challenge it. I believe you and I are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in history, including the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee or climbed the mountains of Judea. Now, that's a preposterous statement, that you and I are being moved into a time in which, about which the Bible says more than it does about the gospel period. Now, to check that out, you got to do two things. You got to find out what the Bible really says. That's too important to delegate that to an underinformed. You got to do it yourself. Find out what the Bible says. And secondly, find out what's going on. And with internet and other resources available, it takes a little homework, but you can do that. And we have a number of paths to what we call the ultimate adventure. We have, if you haven't done it, we encourage you to go through the Bible in our in 24 sessions. We have workbooks as well as DVDs and CD-ROMs to accomplish that. If you survive that ordeal, we encourage you to go through the Bible book by book, verse by verse, with any teacher that you find comfortable. We have expositional commentaries in that format, in the forms of tapes, traditionally, CD-ROMs, MP3s, also in DVDs, which are great for group studies especially. We also publish topical briefings like on biotech or like this one. And so there's over 100 of these available. And there are other resources. We publish a monthly journal. We'll give you a year free if you're interested to see if you like it, and we hope you get addicted to it. We have an internet site, one of the largest and oldest sites on the net. Check it out. No one can pronounce Koinonia House, let alone spell it. Everyone calls us K-House, so we're khouse.org. We monitor these strategic trends. You'll find this material on the, in one form or another on the net. We publish a free weekly bulletin, a one-pager. It tells you what happened this week that's biblically relevant, and it gives you the internet links that follow that competently. That's free. So check it out. And we also helped initiate and are encouraging people to use the Blue Letter Bible, which has the entire Bible, English, Hebrew, Greek, along with commentaries, dictionaries, encyclopedias. All that is free, and it's all word searchable. Check it out. But our primary thrust is to encourage you, if you're serious about your Christian walk, to get into a home fellowship. Check it out. Find one. If you can't find one, start one. We'll be glad to help you if you want us to. We're part of a trust that has two arms, the Koinonia House, which is the publisher of these things, and Koinonia Institute, which I might presumptuously call a think tank that supports this. Koinonia House is one of the largest electronic publishers in the Christian field with CD-ROMs and our internet things, and we have an online fellowship you can join. The Institute conducts studies in these strategic areas through a network of research associates. We also can provide graduate course credit, university course credit, for all of our materials. And the Institute provides three basic tracks. of study. What we call the Berean Tract after Acts 17:11. That's basically that's saying the Bible verse by verse. What we call the Issachar Tract from 1 Chronicles 12:32, to be like the sons of Issachar who understood the times and knew what their country had to do. And then we have the coin, what we call the Koinonos Tract after Exodus 20 verse 7, which says, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." We believe that that has to do with ambassadorship more than it does vocabulary. So our goal is to turn believers into Bereans and to help train, equip ambassadors for Christ in whatever calling you find yourself. We encourage you to check us out, and if we can help you raise the bar on your own spiritual walk, we'd love to do that.